Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. The Planetary Health Alliance, based out of Johns Hopkins University, is a non-profit coalition of more than 450 organizations from over 75 countries, all working to address and mitigate the human health impacts of our disruption of Earth's natural systems, and of course, trying to stop the disruption too. The Alliance consists of respected, hardworking, well-informed environmental and health professionals. It has a powerful, science-informed body of knowledge developed over the last decade, showing how to live on planet Earth so that future generations can successfully grow and thrive and seek fulfillment. But it has struggled to help other scientists and ordinary citizens, and of course policymakers, understand their critically important message. So the Alliance has hired Andrea Copeland as its digital librarian. Her task is to make the research-driven message from the Alliance and take it and deliver it to the rest of the world. A particularly challenging assignment because Andrea is the first person the Planetary Health Alliance has ever hired to do this. She's had to develop a communication strategy from scratch. Now, Andrea has important and relevant in-depth expertise and experience in the storing and translation of knowledge into accessible language and compelling displays. And Andrea is also a trained professional musician, who has developed ideas about the social role of music and the creative arts. Andrea and I are going to discuss not only how documents, visual imagery and displays, and music can attract and inform the public, we're also going to focus on how music and artistic expression in general can move and inspire hearts as well as minds. So Andrea, we're delighted to have you join us today in the studio. It's wonderful to welcome you in.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, when I was reading that sort of job description, I felt a little intimidated by what it all meant. What was it like for you when, the job was available and you signed up and, sent in your application and found out what you were going to, what you expected to do? What was that like as a human experience?
That's a great question. I think initially I saw the posting in my sort of routine job searching. I was looking for the next professional step and I saw this position and I was reading through it and thinking, gosh, this sounds really cool, but I don't really have an environmental science or life science background and I'm not a health sciences librarian. So why would they ever want me? And then I wrote my application letter and sort of talked about my personal relationship with the natural environment growing up in Colorado, how much I, cared for the planet. And somehow it worked. they hired me. And then that's sort of really where it got real because I realized what a massive job I was stepping into and really the sort of truly global scope of this work is. And I will say, just based on your intro, I didn't have to do all the communications from scratch because we have this incredible communications team that just really moves mountains. but I sort of started the process of getting the scholarly communications going. And I think, balancing those two and figuring out how to externalize this message and build the movement definitely became the centerpiece of my work there.
And I was reading through the work that they said you were doing on the website, and I was thinking this exemplifies the problem that you were just describing, which is translating scholarly wisdom into language that non-scholars and non-scientists can understand. And here's the description of what you're supposed to be doing. Her work centers on equipping users and communities with strategies to navigate complex informational environments and to access credible research in the field of planetary health. As an informationist, she leverages design thinking to build common sense discovery and knowledge management tools that help the PHA expand the reach of its mission. Now, I don't know what listeners are thinking when I read this out, but when I read it out myself, I was thinking, okay, if I think about this carefully, I can kind of get an idea of what's supposed to go on here. But as your first assignment today in your work, tell us what you need to do to get that scholarly messages out into the world and make it understandable.
So that's a really apt call out on academic gobbledygook that we are all sort of... I guess prone to working at Johns Hopkins, really any higher ed institution, as you probably know. But I guess I'll start with sort of navigating the complex informational system. Since the Internet of Things, which is meaning like, you know, we're no longer building MySpace pages and accumulating things, the Internet has taken on a life of its own and has all of these digital objects that start there rather than being ingested there. We've had the sort of like profusion of information made extremely widely available. And it's this great, ideally, like tool of democratization, right? Like everybody can, if you can get to the internet, you can get whatever information you need. However,
and you can put whatever you want up on the internet, and who knows if it's really reasonable.
Exactly. And that was my next point. And like, how do you know what parts of the internet you should be querying, or like what is an authoritative sort of like voice on planetary health, or you know, whatever you observed your dog doing on a walk and you look up pet MD or whatever, you know? Right. So there are all of these sort of like markers of expertise that we might not interrogate very closely and just take for granted. And now, you know, you even have like AI summaries on your Google search, which I think is maddening because it's just sort of like the top ranked responses, and that could be changed if somebody's like paid to have their results surfaced first. Yes. So just in that answer, you can kind of get an idea of the complexity of the information systems we're dealing with. So when I got to the Planetary Health Alliance, there's, you know, not only sort of this global knowledge base, but there's also our very small at the time bibliography that we had that was really sort of someone's like EndNotes library exported, and you know, it didn't really have a taxonomy or, you know, conceptual buckets organizing it. It was all just sort of like 1200 resources thrown onto a web page, and a lot of information and not a lot of, okay, what do I actually want to know? Or translation. So what do you mean by biogeochemical flows? And, you know,
yes. Yesterday I had a biogeochemical flow and it was really bothering me. So I took an aspirin and I felt a lot better.
Yeah, exactly. So there are all these sort of like terms that are highly specialized, just like that job description.
Yes, it is.
I think it's really the art of translation is what I was supposed to be doing, and then sort of making that translation into what librarians call discoverable buckets. So like this, if something is discoverable, you can find it. And so putting that information into something that makes sense on our new website that was launched last March.
Thinking about this and reading this description from the website of the Planet Health Alliance made me think, well, there's got to be the word that popped in my head was splainer. Okay. The word splainer is usually mansplainer, and there's a very, very powerful history of, you know, well, ma'am, I've got all the answers here, you need to know. But this was from the Urban Dictionary, and it said, a splainer, not a mansplainer, uses humor and fun to explain things and make them understandable. Splainers often rely on themes, metaphors or mixed metaphors, props, situations, displays. Now this sounds like a more down-to-earth, it's a little bit frivolous, but it's more down-to-earth approach to what the task is that you have ahead of you. Like to make it so people maybe laugh or they cry or you touch them some way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have this sort of esoteric role that can be simplified into a splainer role that also kind of, like, as I sort of worked with the Alliance more, realized that, you know, to build a movement, you have to actually move people in some way. And so maybe that's the connection between splainer and being part of the planetary health movement.
When you were sending in your application, was there a response around music? Was there a response, or the arts? Did they say, well, that's really something that we know we need to add in? Or did they just kind of pass over that as saying, well, that's nice, you know, and we all like music? Did they understand that it could have a role in communicating?
I think the Alliance has always done a good job of understanding where the arts and humanities can have the sort of splainer role or movement building role and sort of accessibility for folks that maybe haven't encountered planetary health before. But I didn't really highlight it in my application. But what I do always say, no matter what job I'm applying for or what role or, you know, what have you, is I do always call up my musical background, because it's about a lot of collaboration, a lot of communication that are inherent in doing any musical task, and a lot of problem solving and rapid cycle testing. And those are all like pretty, you know, close correlates to the scientific process when you think about it. To be a good musician is to be a good scientist. And I think, you know, I may mention those things more casually in an interview or a cover letter, but I think it becomes evident in, you know, who I am on a team. And I think that's sort of how they started thinking, okay, well, she can do this library stuff, but she can also, like, take on some of this art stuff, too. Like, we've kind of got, like, an ace in the hole, like...
I'm kind of imagining you at a big meeting with a lot of very serious scientists talking with, as you say, gobbledygook, very, very long, you know, polysyllabic descriptions of things. And you pull out your oboe, and just so listener knows, that's the instrument that you have learned to play at considerable skill. Pull out your oboe and say, by the way, I'm going to play some music for you that may change your perspective or give you a sense that there's more than just verbal communication. You can communicate. I'm thinking of there's a famous movie tune. It's an oboe tune from a film about the destruction of indigenous culture in South America. I'm trying to remember the name of the film, but there's an oboe solo tune that's extremely evocative and is played over and over by lots of people, oboes and, you know, any other kind of treble instrument. And it's very powerful, and it's sort of a lament for the departure of indigenous cultures. And I'm sure, have you ever been asked to contribute musically to any of the gatherings of the Planetary Health Alliance? Or are we going to talk about for the first time here on community radio, and then the podcast will stir them up somehow?
Yeah, I think I was asked for the One Planet, One Health conference that took place this past spring, if there were any sort of environmentally motivated pieces I could perform. And I said, yes, but for a price, because I'm a professional musician and I've been doing this longer than some of our interns have been alive. Not that that was a non-starter, but I think, you know, classical music has this reputation for being non-participatory. And so I sort of like told them, yes, I'm, you know, happy to do this. Here's my hourly rate. But also, I think, you know, a different thing might work better for this particular setting and audience, which is, you know, a real challenge that music faces generally.
Yeah, and I've been to gatherings put on by scientific organizations where they've cleverly put a guitarist playing in the corner, playing some lovely music. And afterwards, people remember the music, and they're not sure they remember what happened in the conference. They remember generally, but it's the music that sort of catches their attention and diverts them away from just sort of left-brain activities. When you were hired, there was funding available for you to be hired, and it came from a foundation called the Grace and Harold Sewell Memorial Fund, which is ironically set up not by them, but by their daughter, who was a librarian. And your background in librarianship in the performing arts led to you being described by this foundation as, and your work highlighting the connections between arts, medical humanities, and planetary health.
Mm.
Did that seem like kind of a bit of a green light for you to bring your whole experience into this work, as opposed to just, you know, translating in from gobbledygook into plain English? I don't want to use the word gobbledygook too much, because the work of the Planetary Health Alliance is revered around the world, and there's 450 organizations affiliated with, so they do an amazing and wonderful job. But just in terms of what you've been able to do in your day-to-day work.
Yeah, I think absolutely it was a green light to sort of go forth and make the connections I felt were appropriate, which is pretty rare when you start something, or rather, I wish it weren't so rare when you start someplace. That sort of speaks to the qualities of the organization and sort of the nature of the movement, which is all encompassing. It's everything change is something that we, you know, very frequently say at the Alliance. But I think, you know, the science at this point about climate change, about its impacts on human health, about, you know, the massive environmental changes sort of taking place is irrefutable. And almost everybody knows it, even though, unfortunately, some people are in denial. And that's all that's the only explanation I can have for it, is that it's uncomfortable and they're in denial.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think the connection, you know, particularly with arts and medical humanities and sort of like any sort of notion of arts and humanities and then a hard science, is to get at the humanity involved in science, because humanity is curious and humanity is persevering and community oriented. And I think the arts and humanities explore that, and the sciences maybe give us more concrete answers for why we explore it, but you still have to sort of find a common ground to meet on and say, wow, humans do amazing stuff. Like, we've got a lot of problems and we've caused a lot of problems, but ultimately we do a lot of amazing stuff. And I think it's just that moment of appreciation for humanity and exploring, you know, like, yes, we can do this science, but you can also play an incredible violin concerto. And it's equally, you know, the capacity for humans to do both or to play the Olympics is all sort of amazing. And so I think of both the sort of like celebratory and sort of like boundary pushing.
I want to ask you about a typical day for in your sort of work environment, but I also wanted to mentioned that you'd had a conversation with Sam Myers, and Sam Myers, for people who don't know, is the overall head of the Planetary Health Alliance and the Planetary Health Institute, I think it is, that's sort of in parallel at Johns Hopkins. And you had a conversation at a supper, and he was very explicit enunciating this concern that we've got to get our ideas across to people. We have to tell people why we're concerned in such a way that it does move them. What was that like talking to the boss, just like two people talking?
I mean, the great thing about Sam is that it almost always feels like just two people talking, even though he's done these amazing things and is, you know, this incredibly impressive person, you know, on paper. And, you know, in reality, he's just an impressive human. Mm-hmm. But I think that's probably why he's in the role that he's in, is because he is very approachable and very sincere and earnest about the need to really grab people through their emotional capacity and make them connect to the science that way. Mm-hmm. And he was really emphatic in this particular interaction about the potential in children's books and how from a young age you can sort of socialize people to have this more environmentally sustainable ethic and this more humane approach to the planet we live on and each other. Yeah. And some of our most successful arts outreach projects have been through youth organizations. And so I just found it really interesting that, you know, here's this, you know, for lack of a better term, like famous guy saying, yeah, there should be more like art and literature about this.
And children's literature in particular.
Children. Yeah. And like, that's the ultimate like accessibility, right? And you know, you think about like all this children's programming that has made such a difference to people's like basic education, like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood or Reading Rainbow, you know, all of this sort of this body of work. And my response, because I'm a pretty casual person, I was like, yeah, right on. Of course. You know, and he's
that's a good response.
Yeah.
We actually, on a different subject, on the food issue of food, had an opportunity to interview Sam about a year and a half, 2 years ago. I can't remember exactly. And I asked him about his children. You know, is he worried for his children? He said, no, because my children live in a country where there are so many privileges, so many opportunities, but I'm worried about children in parts of the world. And on the cover of a book that he had, I don't know if he wrote it or participated in it, there was a picture of some children from, I think it was Tibet. He said, those are the children I'm worried about. And because they don't have the same support system that children here in our part of the world have. And I thought that was a very, I mean, he's talking about his own children, you know, in very directly part of his life, but he said, well, my kids will be okay. It's those other children out there that I'm concerned about. So what does a digital library technician person do when she's at work? What is the kind of stuff that you do when you're on the job?
I'm going to preface this with a big part of my job was being, on the project team that rebuilt our Planetary Health Alliance website.
Okay.
And so that had to do a lot with, I mentioned the word taxonomy before, so sort of developing these conceptual buckets. And, you know, we had buckets for environmental, you know, change, health impacts, sectors of the economy, and then sort of this other category that, you know, caught youth movements and indigenous knowledge and, you know, sort of kind of how do we unite all of these things and make it navigable for anybody who's like, what the heck is planetary health? So there was a lot of, I guess, conceptual work that went into the early part of my job that I can't really like say, I wake up at, you know, 7 a.m. and then I sit on the train for 45 minutes. And the first thing I do is think about taxonomies. But it was
breakfast. You have breakfast.
Right, exactly. But sort of like related to that, it also became a lot of my job, you know, would be sort of goal setting with my boss and thinking about, okay, so if we're trying to move this forward with the website today, what do we need to figure out conceptually so that we have a place to put all of this information that we're migrating. And so it was really like very basic library classification work at the beginning. And then it turned into copy editing. And then once, you know, the website was up, it was very about like, okay, now we've got this thing. How do we maintain this thing? And how do we work with our various teams, like the education team, the Institute for Planetary Health, which is, you know, the sort of Hopkins hub that we have, And with all of these collaborators, regional hubs, members, to sort of make sure that this information is relevant to them and up to date to them. Sure. So it became a lot more about building infrastructure for the continued logical organization of our information, if that makes sense. So that looks a little bit different every day.
Yes, I'm sure it would be, because there are a lot of things changing every day. If you were going to assume that I just walked in off the street and I didn't really know what planetary health was all about, and you were saying, all right, here we are, I've got this challenge. I have to make sure that this person who doesn't really know a lot about the subject can understand what planetary health means and why it's important and why he, in this case, should pay attention to it and incorporate thoughts about planetary health into his or her daily life.
I would say that planetary health unites multiple sciences to demonstrate that environmental impacts are rapidly accelerating. The health of the planet based on those environmental impacts is at stake. And also our health as humans and humanity is at stake. And when you talk about the planet, you're not just talking about these environmental changes or these health impacts. You're talking about how they interact and how we interact with this planet Earth that we are on, and how it's all one system and it needs to be cured, basically. Like, what can we do in how we live our lives mm-hmm. to increase the planet's health, thereby increasing our health? And I think I mentioned this earlier in the talk, but it's everything change. So, you know, mm-hmm. if we have this rapidly changing planet, how are we going to change our systems to adapt? How are we going to change our energy infrastructure? How are we going to change our healthcare practices? And I'm going to stop there, because you can just keep going with it.
Well, you know, when you said it's an everything thing, that yeah. is something, it seems to me, both the Planetary Health Alliance and just everybody else, is a new way of looking at things, because we've always kind of had local perspectives. All our ancestors, for the longest time, we were curious about things outside our immediate purview and our immediate location. But now we all you have to do is turn on a computer and hit a button, and suddenly you're seeing people living their daily lives on the other side of the planet. I mean, you can choose right. to do so, or you can choose not to do so, but you can't say it isn't there. And at right. one point you could say, well, we never think about it because we can't do it. But now we can right. do it. It seems to me that brings out universal values and universal principles when you say, well, this affects everything, or everything is being affected by what's going right. on. Do you have that sense?
I do, and I hope it's the sense that other people have. However, I think it's also sort of this developing awareness that what you do at the local level affects things at the global level, mm-hmm. you know, thinking mm-hmm. about sort of the top pollution producers in the world and things like that. Right. And I think that's, again, where we sort of circle back around to the arts, because you can be in your local art scene and like have real conversations with people, whether or not they're Sam Myers at like, you know, geographically located, or like, you know, your neighbor, and say, I work for this organization, or like, yeah, I'll join the, you know, sort of neighborhood cleanup next Saturday, whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But those sort of things do ripple outwards. And it's, I guess, my way of conceptualizing it, and maybe this is like Pollyanna-ish of me, is like, if everybody sort of takes a stake locally, then everybody's doing it globally. Because, like, if somebody's doing the same thing I'm doing, you know, across the planet or in Australia, then, like, everybody's doing a little bit of something, and many hands make light work. Mm-hmm. But that's why that's part of the everything change as I conceptualize it.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's actually very fitting with what people with 25 degrees after their names are starting to understand, and what ordinary people in their daily lives are starting to understand. If you think carefully and reflect on what you're doing in your own life, then you can be just as much of a change agent as if you're the president, prime minister, pope, you know, leader of this, that, or the other corporation. You know, you all are, every one of us is playing a role, and it's just as important for us all to do our local stuff. Could you describe a situation where music was added on to what was going on in an event or a process that was a planetary health process? I'm squeezing you to see if you can say, yes, I've got the music in there.
Well, okay. So I will say two things that I think are pretty significant to the Planetary Health Alliance's work and music. One is that, you know, we have this annual meeting called FAM, so the Planetary Health Annual Meeting, and it's hosted all over the world. And whether it's in Malaysia or the Netherlands or Japan, there's always a arts component for sort of sharing what is the local art. Either like there's an institutional tour of a museum, and there's almost always a performance in the ceremony, you know, closing, beginning, what have you. There's also a lot of music and art at the COP meetings. So it has a big place there, and we were able to contribute to some of that compendium with an organization. What sort of evolved as, I guess, my capacity in planetary health and my literacy in it and sort of my knowledge of the field developed, and then it sort of started intersecting and generating more thoughts about sort of my musical training and expertise and things like that. So one of the things that I got to do in my role that was really, really cool was start a Planetary Health and the Arts webinar series. And so we were able to host artists from different regional hubs to share their work and how it was either speaking to planetary health or contributing to the movement. And that was really, really cool.
What kind of response did the people who were participating have to that? I mean, obviously, you were directly involved in kind of setting it up, but you would have heard what people were saying and the remarks that they made about this combination, which is, it's odd that we don't have this combination as part of our cultural norms. We don't think right. We have music over here in a concert hall, and we have a lecture over there in an academic theater. And here you are bringing them together. Paul, how were people responding to that?
So the way the scheduling worked internationally, they were often very early on my end. And so it was getting up at 6, 7 a.m. And I know you guys are up early to talk to me today with our time change. But my boss and I and a lot of my teammates were often in those webinars. And obviously I was moderating them. But we would just have these moments afterwards of, whoa, I need to like take a beat and absorb what I just learned or what, like how I feel about this, or like just the amazing film that we just screened, or like this artist's work. It was truly, I would say, humbling and inspiring, because it was sort of a view into work that's happening, you know, more locally that like you wouldn't know about if you hadn't talked to someone who's a local artist elsewhere, but now they're on this global platform, you know? So it was very, very cool. And it was very cool to walk out of those presentations and just have to sit back for a minute and breathe, because you know, maybe if we all took more pauses like that, we would like appreciate, you know, nature more, or like say, gosh, isn't it weird that there's a 50 degree temperature swing between, you know, yesterday and today, stuff like that is like,
yeah, it does seem that feeling of being inspired is sort of a necessary accompaniment of doing work. I mean, it's one thing to work for in a job where you say, well, I'm, you know, moving widgets around and I get paid to do it. And the big deal in the job is talking to my fellow workers about, you know, what they're doing in their lives. I'm not the slightest bit interested in the work I'm doing. It's just a means to an end. But to actually have work and subject matter that stirs you up at a profound level. Mm-hmm. You said at one point that the people who work in the Planetary Health Alliance are the hardest working group of people I've been part of. Do you want to expand on that a little bit? What makes it different? Why do they work so hard?
I think it's hard to, you know, put into words, but I think everybody sort of knows the stakes of the proposition and how important it is to do this work. And it brings in so many people from so many different fields because, again, it's transdisciplinary. It's everything changed. So you have public health researchers with MDs, with like professors, all sort of, you know, saying there are maybe a dozen of us on this core team and we've got a global task. And it was kind of like every day that I walked into the office, it was like, all right, let's get after it. Like, what can we do today? And I think it was just really cool because we weren't, you know, there. It's really hard to build a movement and it's really hard to navigate, you know, different political systems and bureaucracies and things like that. And some days you have to worry about, okay, we have these educational videos. Who does the copyright belong to? Because the Health Alliance moved from Harvard to Johns Hopkins, you know? So there's stuff like that obviously would happen, but like, there's always sort of that like motivating who is our audience in our work. And when the audience is like humanity, it's
everybody.
Kind of, yeah, it's not like it is motivating and it's not like we're, you know, I don't want to like sound egotistical or anything, but like we're trying really hard to change the world. Mm-hmm. And we see the way that, you know, people who like every day are in operating rooms, you know, saving somebody's life can be part of the same movement that we are trying to put a name to and call it planetary health, if that makes sense.
I don't think that indicates personal ambition so much as a recognition. I mean, I'm explaining that you don't have to feel bad about that because it seems to me that what you're aspiring towards is making things better for everybody. You know, right. It's like the largest possible altruistic motive you could have as a human being is to try and make things better for everybody that you know or even don't know, just working on that kind of an approach. And when it's out in the open, as it is with the Planetary Health Alliance, nobody's pretending that you're doing something, you know, for your local business community. You're doing something for your local business community and every other business community on planet Earth, which is it's a different kind of mission. Now, you've actually written or co-authored a book about explaining what's happening in the digital world called Unlocking the Digital Age: A Musician's Guide to Research, Copyright, and you mentioned the word copyright a moment ago, copyright and publishing. And it seems to me that's a task that you took on, you and your co-author took on, to make it possible for people who are in the musical world to have a sense of fairness and a sense of opportunity that is not, there's no trickery involved. It's you can wend your way through this sort of digital system with all these rules about copyright and intellectual property rights in general and publishing and who does it and who gets paid for it and who has to pay for it. It seems to me that the essence of that book, if I understand it properly, is to give tools to people so that they can have this technical stuff out of the way. And they can get on with playing music or listening to music or collaborating with other musicians. So tell me what it was really about, the book. I hope I am close.
You're very close, but I think you just summed up probably the ambition of every instruction librarian and most librarians I know. And that's to connect people to the resources they need to live their best lives, be their most creative selves. You know, it's like sort of this unlocking of, you know, give people what they need and then they start thriving, sort of hierarchy of needs. We're trying to meet a lot of those basic needs, whether it's in music or, you know, other information literacy topics.
Did you include that book in your application for the job? Did you mention it?
I believe it was, I'm trying to remember if I applied with my academic CV or not. It's on my academic CV, but I admit fully to being a somewhat jaded former academic, and so I no longer apply to jobs or positions or service roles or anything that requires this sort of academic pageantry.
You're a rehabilitated former academic.
Something like that.
You also wrote a little bit about, in the musical world, about fairness and misogyny. And I think that's a pretty universal topic, the respect or lack of it that is offered to women in various kinds of work. Why don't you talk about that in terms of these broad planetary themes? Even though it's just music, you might say, or just women, you might say, but it's really music and women are essential to the human experience. You know, there wouldn't be any of us here if there wasn't a woman among us. We would not exist. So what were you trying to get at when you were writing about fairness and mistreatment of women in musical circles? I mean, I think you were annoyed, appropriately annoyed.
Yes, well, before I was rehabilitated, as you said, I was working very hard to be a public music historian and, you know, sort of keeping this theme with how do I bring people to music and help them enjoy it when they feel like, oh, I'm not enough of a elite individual to sit in a symphony and understand what's going on. And my whole spiel is, you don't have to be. And yes, you are. It's for everybody. Mm. So, you know, there's a theme in all these areas of work. And, you know, it's I don't have to tell anybody that there are centuries of operatic works devoted to the mistreatment of women as a central plot point. And the fact that the Vienna Philharmonic only just started letting women sit in it, you know, within the past 50 years is bananas. but that's just sort of the way the patriarchy cookie crumbles. And I think, you know, in these systems, as soon as you set up a system for winners and losers, whether it's the professional orchestral world, whether it's capitalism, anybody with fewer resources is starting behind the starting line and has further to travel. And it's sort of this notion of equality versus equity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, speaking frankly, as a woman who, you know, I'm in my 30s, and I think I spent probably the first 10 years of my working life, you know, 25 to 35, being treated like a child, you know, or like you're starting out, or you're the fresh young buck with, you know, all these aspirations and ideas above your pay grade and whatever. and now sort of like looking at the next stage of my career, which will be like, well, you're not desirable societally. So how are you going to be listened to in the workplace? You know, it's sort of this constant cycle. And so of course, as someone who wants to talk publicly and educate publicly about music, and as someone who identifies as a female and someone who just believes in greater equity in the world, I'm going to pop off about the unfairness inherent in the system.
Well, I think you should be in charge. How would that be if you could be in charge and say, no more of this stuff, anybody? You know, the thing, of course, it can't be mandated. It can't be mandated. It has to be experienced and felt.
Right.
You have to do it. Now, you grew up in the wilds of Colorado, not exactly the same as the urban landscape of Baltimore. Your father was from England, and you kind of had some back and forth. You even at one point, I think, thought you might even live back in England at something. But you were an outdoors young woman. You skied, you climbed, you ran.
Yes.
So why don't you connect a few dots that led to the kind of work you're doing now that really, really kind of pushed things. You mentioned two things, and you can explain them. First of all, the movie Dances with Wolves. Well, the second one is the Hayman Fire. Okay.
Okay, yeah. So both of these things are pretty early in my sort of adolescent development of conceptualizing and understanding the world, whatever you want to call
it's
it.
It's where everything starts to happen in real time for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just like a couple of things sort of landed for me. So I'll start with Dances with Wolves. I watched that film on my own. I don't know why. And was completely taken with it. And it sounds so cheesy because I think people probably make fun of this film.
No,
whatever, but
it's not cheesy. I'm forewarning you, it's not cheesy.
But it's I think it was the first, you know, I had watched, you know, films. I was probably 11 or 12 because these events are around the same time. But I had watched films before where I was, you know, oh, something sad happens or something scary happens or, you know, what is this love thing people are on about? But I think that was the first one that I really connected to, living in a fragile ecosystem myself. And the scene where, the, you know, sort of, indigenous people at the center of the film who take in this ailing Civil War soldier go out for their yearly like bison hunt that is, you know, meant to provide this sort of sustainable system of life, literally sustenance, like for them for an entire year. And they get to their hunting grounds and the cavalry has moved through and slaughtered an entire herd of buffalo and all the carcasses are wasted and rotting on the prairie and there's nothing left. And I'm like, that is like so apt. Everybody should see this film and leave Colorado because there's no resources for anybody. And I still like to this day think about that devastating scene of just the main characters going off into the snowy woods at the very end, just in this, you know, it's like they're going to constantly be on the move until they're caught, or like, you know, this is the rest of their lives. They can never rest anywhere. They can never have, you know, sort of this sustainable way of life again. Mm. So I think I found it devastating in kind of a profound way for like a, you know, 11, 12 year old. And I was like, okay, this is my worldview of like, this is not right. And of course, it was reinforced by sort of the concurrent, I guess, in my timeline, the Hayman forest fire, which burned hundreds of thousands of acres in Colorado. You know, the sky was dark as though, you know, a storm was incoming for the weeks that went on. You couldn't go outside at recess because of the air quality. And, you know, this horribly traumatic thing happened. But then when I started backpacking later in high school, the first wilderness area I went to was significantly impacted by the Hayman burn. And so sort of driving into this trailhead, you would see sort of the bald shapes of the mountains. And growing up looking at the mountains, I'm like, I didn't know they could be bald, you know, or I didn't know that like they looked like that under the trees. And then all of a sudden the trees come back where the burn ends. And it's just this beautiful, idyllic, sun-dappled thing that you want to backpack through. So, you know, that's one person's sort of mistake that, you know, sort of reshaped an entire ecosystem. And of course, the underlying plot point here is that the reason these forest fires are so devastating is that people build houses in national forests. And in defense of the houses during seasonal burns, which are a quite natural process, we preserve too much of the dead undergrowth. And you have this simultaneous issue of the winters not being cold enough anymore to kill off this insect called the pine beetle, which is killing all of these pine trees and deadening out. So you've just got the tinderbox in this already sort of like water scarce environment. And you know what? Of course, it's going to catch fire. So those are very long-winded answers, but it just sort of like brought sort of like the consequences of human like interactions with nature home to rest, I guess.
What you're describing is sort of a holistic response to an event that was powerful, of course. Just for some numbers, 138,000 acres were burned, 600 buildings were burned. One woman died from smoke inhalation. She was an elderly woman, and the smoke and had asthma, and she died from that. And five firefighters were killed on the way to the fire. There was a traffic accident because they were racing to help join the team that was working on the fire. The word that you used that was sort of the source of anger and frustration was the word greed. When we were talking about it earlier, you said that this was emblematic of greed, the suppression of forest fires in order to preserve wood as a fiber product that could be cut down and sold, and building houses in the park so that you could have this wonderful sylvan environment. The person who started the fire, I was astonished to learn, had burned a letter that had been written to her from her estranged boyfriend, and she burned it in an open fire. When open fire, she was an employee of the Park Service. She burned it in open fire and just tossed it in. And of course, it caught on to the tinder dry brush. Talk about somebody being disconnected to reality. It was a superb. She ended up going to jail and only recently got released. Now, music was a parallel thing. We're getting close to the end of the show, but I want to just make sure that everybody understands that there's a real component of music. You have bachelor degrees in music before moving on into library science. You play the oboe professionally in orchestras, symphony orchestras, and music history was a focus of your studies as well. And I think that combination of history and performance, an actual experiential performance, it seems to me that's sort of almost a metaphor for what we're doing. We're having experiences that are moving us from moment to moment, but we have to put into the context of the empirical knowledge we have of our own history as a species and our behaviors towards other species. It's sort of like mixing the high level and the low level, the direct experience with the intellectual analysis of it. Does that sound right for kind of the place you're in right now?
Yeah, I really like that, actually. And I always think, whenever I think about a really good musician, I'm like, wow, they're such a jock, like they're so good at what they do. They're so practiced and trained and, in shape or whatever. But yeah, I think that that's absolutely it. And it's not that everybody has to be an expert in everything, but to bring it to a current example, I would say that the sort of AI revolution is a really good example, because you're given a lot of good raw information into these LLMs. And what it does is think, okay, Dr. Warren Bell, these are your pre-existing, conversations, radio show transcripts, publications, and the CV that we found online randomly. And you must have written this one article that is about, turning primary practice into community engagement through planetary health conversations. And no such article exists, So like the deductive reasoning is flawed in that way. And I think that's really where humans can step in. That's where the PHA can step in. That's where you, librarians, anybody who's doing this sort of like splainer work can be, no, it's like attributed to very specific things. So the specific context, the specific history does matter. And that's where you start making sense of these sort of like summative statements, like it's everything change.
You have just offered a superb summary of what we've been talking about for the last hour. Andrea, this is what we're all doing. We're parlaying our own individual experiences into broad convictions about the whole world. And that's the only way we can do it. So I don't think what you described is anything other than the necessary process that everyone has to go through. It's really been a treat to have you on the show today, to talk about these things, to talk about things that are normally kept in separate silos, but are really part of the same experience that all of us share. I want to thank you for being with us. I am convinced that the work you're going to do with the Planetary Health Alliance is going to make changes that are important and valuable, just because I think you're like all the rest of us. You're sincere, you're trying to do the right thing, and you're kind of motivated from a deeper place than just, you know, the pay schedule. It's something deep inside you. And thank you for sharing that part of your own life. Thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me and platforming this kind of work. It's amazing. And so happy to have these conversations.
Thank you.